Accession number 30047, reel number 1.
Look how he's doo doo da doodly doo dooing.
Little Jean Freeman sat on her Roger Freeman, and that's about all she did, really.
And if you want to stop, just press that one.
This is Fred Fisk. I was the radio operator aboard the lead plane of Squadron 700, 445th Bombardment Group, which set out to bomb the locomotive works at Kassel, Germany on September 27th, 1944. Unknown to me and the rest of the crew at the time was the fact that we were 30 miles off course. Unfortunately, it was my navigator who made that error. I sat there on the liaison set, which was the long-range radio set, in contact with our base back in England, while all the other members of the crew were tuned into the intercom. Suddenly, I heard the guns firing in the turret in my compartment, which was manned by the flight engineer. I immediately switched to intercom and heard all the excited chatter among the other members of the crew. Here comes one guy at 6 o'clock left, you know, and so on. And it turned out that the Germans had spotted this one group separated from the rest of the attack force by some 30 miles and sent up some 150 Focke-Wulf 190s, all of whom came in at 6 o'clock level, outnumbering about 5 to 1. And they took a very, very heavy toll indeed. I can recall seeing our high left squadron shot out of the air within 60 seconds. 11 planes went down. I can see the face practically of a German fighter pilot who came round my position and looked back, and I thought that I really established eye contact with him at one point. The action started at 10:03 that morning. We called for fighter cover, and the fighters, a very fine P-38 group of fighters, came to where we should have been. Unfortunately, we weren't there because we were off course, and we were over Göttingen rather than Kassel. It took them 6 minutes to find us. The action lasted from 10:03 to 10:09. When we looked out and saw the welcome sight of those P-38s, they engaged the Germans, who took flight. They really had no heart for combat with the P-38s. They took off, and we looked around, and we were all alone in the air. There was only one plane of our 34, which got back to our base in England. One plane crash-landed in Belgium. We were crippled. We were crippled. Two engines out. Left vertical stabilizer virtually destroyed. Gasoline pouring through the bomb bay. And all alone in the sky, we thought that we would try, if we could, to get over the enemy lines to make it to France. We P-38 sat with us for maybe 10 or 15 minutes with full flaps. Finally, they had to leave. We continued. We knew that the lines then were along the river. I think the Rhone River. I'm not certain. We flew for a while and finally saw a river below us. And the navigator thought that might be the river. No sooner than we discussed it, flak came up. And that was convincing evidence that that wasn't the Rhone River. My antennas were shot off, but I had a trailing wire antenna with which I thought I could get a long-range fix from back in England. The problem was that gasoline had been pouring through the bomb bay, and I feared that if I let the trailing wire out, it went through the bomb bay and touched the key, that we might explode. But we chanced it anyway, and I was able to get a long-range fix. We knew where we were. That being necessary, because while we were jettisoning everything that was loose to lighten the aircraft, we threw out guns and ammunition and tools and everything that was loose. The same navigator whose mistake had resulted in this terrible situation was throwing his flak suit out and threw his charts along with it, which is why...
Ladies and gentlemen, on our port side...
Sorry about that. I had just cut off the recorder because an announcement was being made here on the Vista Fjord. Well,
do you want to see this boat?
Sure, I'd like to. Well, once we had our long-range fix, we had a better idea of where we were located. We kept losing altitude and flying to the west, eventually crossing the enemy lines, and with not a great deal of altitude left, I would suspect maybe 300-400 feet, and we spotted what had been a German fighter strip only days before, and crash landed on it, came in on the belly. We made contact with a group of infantrymen. We didn't have to make contact with them, actually. They came running up in a big circle. We had all our hatches open because gasoline had been pouring through the bomb bay. We feared that when we came in on the belly that the plane might explode. So we had all our hatches open and were preparing to get out of that plane as quickly as possible. When these infantrymen coming up in this big circle saw us jumping from the plane and running from it, they turned around and ran away from it. And it reminded me of a childhood game that many of us played called Here We Go Loop-De-Loo, Here We Go Loop-De-Lie. We spent the night sleeping in tents with these infantrymen, and we were terribly uncomfortable, of course. All of us were still in our heated suits, and we didn't have any of the luxuries that we had back at our base in Tibbenham. I went out the next day and found a spare part, a tuning unit for my liaison set, which I had jettisoned, found it in a wrecked B-25 nearby, had my engineer carry that trailing wire antenna out across the field in a May West, and was able to reach our base back in England. No concerned about how many wounded we might have had. And by the way, nobody on the plane was wounded. And they asked us to guard the aircraft, which wasn't really worth guarding. And 2 days later, sent in an ATC plane and took us back to base, where all of our gear had been gathered up and loaded into mattress bags and stored in a warehouse. For that, I received an oak leaf cluster to the DFC.
Now, when you were under attack, what was the first thing you saw? Did you hear something before you saw the enemy aircraft, or what?
Well, the first thing I heard was the machine guns and the top turret gunner in my compartment. And I looked out and of course, saw German fighter planes. The sight of the swastika is right off our wing, practically, on the tails of those Focke-Wulf 190s. And then, of course, everything happened very, very quickly. I looked up and saw flaming wreckage. I saw two fellows fly through the air without parachutes. I don't know whether they jumped without parachutes or were dead, or whether their parachutes failed to open. But two fellows came right by the window without parachutes.
Did you have time to feel scared or what?
Yes. A combination of feelings, I suspect. Fear, certainly. Surprise. Concern. Wondering what to do. What's that?
You were able to function.
Yes. I thought it was a great disadvantage not to have a gun to fire. I was a qualified gunner. My MOS was 757, which is Radio Operator Mechanic Aerial Gunner. But the top turret, which was in my compartment, was manned by the flight engineer. I was to replace him if he were injured, but fortunately he was not. And so I think it breaks the tension if you're able to do something. If you're able to fire a weapon, it breaks the tension. I was not able to do that, and so I thought to myself first, well, maybe I better make myself as small a target as possible. And so I took a flak suit and sat in a corner and put it over my head. Then I thought, well, this won't do. Everybody's able to bail out, and I won't even be aware of it. So I took it off, and I put my foot up on the bulkhead, the cockpit between the two pilots, and I felt, can you call it, trembling, you know. And the entire action only lasted 6 minutes, so it was over with rather quickly. And the most welcome sight was those P-38s coming in off our starboard side.
Did you clip a chute on?
No, never did put a chute on.
What was your pilot's name?
My pilot's name was French. He was my second pilot, interestingly. I went over with a pilot named Plant, Dick Plant, and flew 14 missions with that crew, and then was grounded on the 15th mission because I had an upset stomach, and that crew was shot down. And
kick it off for a second. Was
following the loss of Plant's crew, I flew with Johnny Burke. That's a name, Roger, that you may remember. He was a kind of a devil-may-care young pilot who completed one tour and then flew a second tour when I was assigned to his crew. And because we had different numbers of flights, I having flown with the first crew and then joined him, he finished up his second tour before I reached my 30th mission, which was Castle, and I was assigned to this French crew to finish up.
You know what his full name was?
I really can't remember what his first name was.
Or his rank?
He was a first lieutenant.
First lieutenant. That was a lead crew.
Yeah.
When you crash landed, wasn't he able to lower the gear?
He may have been able to, although I'm not sure because our hydraulic system had been shot up. But it would have been silly to lower the gear because the fighter strip that we came in on had been bombed and there were craters on the runway. So it would have been a disaster to come in with the landing gear down. We came in on the belly.
You don't know the name of the place, location, the strip?
REM.
Spelt?
REHEIMS. Near city.
And did the aircraft have a name, nickname? Do you remember?
Well, the plane that, interestingly, I heard your lecture a few days ago, and you spoke of a B-17 named Patches.
Yeah.
The plane that I flew on with my regular crew, the crew that was lost, was also named Patches because it was a B-24 mm-hmm. because it had been shot up so much.
It was a common name.
Yeah. The plane that I was in and that we crashed in after the Castle raid, I don't remember the name because I hadn't flown in it regularly.
Mm. I just wondered if it stuck in your memory. Well, that's great.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
But now what is important is you give me your full name and address on there.
All right,
spell out any place names.
I'm Fred Fiske, F as in Frank, ISKE. And the address is 4932 Sentinel Drive, S as in Sam, E-N-T-I-N-E-L, Drive, in Bethesda, B as in Boy, E-T-H-E-S-D-A, Maryland, 20816.
Thank you. I used to stay in...
Well, I know what
works. Is this working? It's working now. When you want to stop it, press that. It's working now. Press that to start it. That was... Oh, yes, but please give your full name beforehand, because I can't recognise voices.
My name is Jim Jones.
My name is Jim Jones. That laughter in the background, Roger, is Jim Jones thought. Now, my name is Bill Billings, one of the original members of the 56th Fighter Group. I had a very special job working for Colonel Schilling called Schilling's Fast Freight. You name it, we truck it. If you need it, we get it.
If you need it, they steal it?
No, we wouldn't steal it. We'd borrow it, but we'd always paint it quick. Now, one day, old Colonel Schilling sent me out to Greenock, Scotland, to find a LST. Now, his... I can't recall whether it was his school chum or his cousin was commander of that boat. We got up there with this truck. The boom come over the side. It was a finger dock, you know, where you pull alongside. And his boom come out, and his big ice cream machine was lowered right over the side.
Where did he get it from?
Off the LST.
But where did they get it from?
Oh, all their ships had ice cream machines. All the Navy ships had ice cream machines.
Really?
Oh, sure.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So when we got it back, Leo Lester's outfit, they modified it that so it would work on the English Electric. So we actually had two separate ice cream machines. John Truluck made one out of cannon shells, garbage cans, and putt-putt motor, you know? Yeah, but it didn't work as long as it wore out. But this one was regular soft cream, you know?
Where were you when you pinched this? When you cracked this?
When we borrowed this?
Yes.
Oh, I forget whether we're in Halesworth or whether we're in Colchester here. I can't go on. See, now
how did Schilling manage to persuade somebody to part with this? I know he had great charm, but...
That was his cousin.
That was either his cousin or a buddy he went to school with.
I see. Who was the captain?
This commander of this LST.
And what did the guys on the LST do for ice cream?
They pinched one off another ship. This one was probably pinched before...
I'm sure they had a spare.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't ask. I know one thing they did. They did give me a case, a 3.2 PON beer. That's Pride of Newark, New Jersey beer. I brought that back with me.
How long did it take you to get up to Greenock?
Pardon?
How long did it take you to get to Greenock?
Greenock in Scotland.
Well, I'll tell you, I was telling somebody else here the other night, we were not allowed to carry maps. The Germans might get them. No, no kidding. We couldn't have all signposts were down. And you ask anybody, you know, an English farmer or something, you say, hey, Mac, what town is up here? Like you say, hey, is that Norwich up there? My name ain't Mac, and that ain't Norwich. I ain't telling you. So it was very simple. England's small. Now, I got paid $5.04 a day for being off the base or driving over the road. So what I would do, I would leave whatever base I was at, I would head east till I hit an ocean, and I would just follow the coastline all the way around. I went all the way down to Land's End and come back all the way up to
who was the other one? To Greenock, you were going north anyway. You must have been able to get to Greenock.
We went north at the end.
Yeah, I went to...
You're not going to tell me you went to Land's End and ran Wales to get to Greenock.
No, I did the very first trip they sent me to Wales. I went that way. I had to get down to Barry Docks and pick up some. But no, Greenock, I knew enough to go up this way. But the best one was when we got to Loch Ness. Sam Horning and I, we had two 2.5-ton trucks with ton trailers. Now, you think these guys driving over the road had the first sleeper cabs? What do you think was on them ton trailers behind us? We had our camp stove, our cots, our mattresses.
What were you doing at Loch Ness?
Looking for the monster. You asked the same question that Bobby did when he stopped us.
Sure you went after whiskey?
Oh, the one on whiskey going to...
Loch Ness on the way.
I was going to say, you were really after whiskey.
In Scotland? No, we went up there for... we went up there for some kind of new bombs they had. And so Sam and I took a little detour. I forget where. Oh, it's nothing to put another 8,000 miles on the truck.
One trailer didn't win, isn't it?
And then they tell us how hard they had in England.
No, but the whiskey we had in Kingscliff, that was funny. We come in, we had been up all night, you know, and so the next day we had the day off. I forget the day. I think it was like the 13th or 14th we had the day off. And so Schilling, Red Dog, and I, we go with some Englishman in some kind of vehicle, and we wind up getting, we got a Hummer staff car, big black Hummer. Oh, boy, what a beautiful car. It had four jacks in it. You could jack it up and take the weight off the tools. If you had a flat, you didn't have to get out and crawl underneath it. And we got this 3-ton Dodge lorry. Well, I had more problems driving this car here than I did the lorry. But when we went down to get our TAT equipment, the...
Are you ready to order your drinks now?
Yes, we have a...
We'll just shut that off.
Oh.
Right.
Okay, now you want to know the story about the Scotch whiskey that was stolen from the... Kingscliff...
Yes.
...railroad station that was investigated by Detective Sergeant Jack...
Neeson.
Well, here's the story. As long as I don't have to pay for the scotch, we went to get this two trucks and cars, and Sam and I were sent with a detail to pick up the TAT equipment. That's to accompany the troops, typewriters and stuff like that, barracks bags. While we were in the station, back in the truck in, somebody spotted a beautiful big pallet of scotch going to the Withering officer's mess room. Yeah, the air base over there.
Mm-hmm.
Each man took two cases. We had put them in the toolbox. It was four bottles to a case. There was straw packed around, which was unusual for us. And we dropped a bottle. So we kicked it underneath the truck. We loaded the truck. We get out of there. We got 23 bottles of scotch back to the base. The next day, Verge Durance, Ray Hancock, Verge Durance was the adjutant. Ray Hancock was the first sergeant, and Jack and another police officer. They went through every barracks. Every man had to stand by the bed. They looked under the bed. They went through the footlockers. Couldn't find a bottle. We didn't tell them, but Colonel Schilling and I went ahead of them. And we picked up the bottles, and we didn't know where to put them, so we put them in the trunk of his car. So when everybody went home, so we opened up the trunk and we passed the whiskey out again. End of story. Stop that.
No one left.
I can remember one time some sergeant from Leo Lester's office gave me a hard time. And so he pulled his rank and put me on KP. So what happened? Old Colonel Schilling come down. He had a special trip for me. I forget where I was going. And he asked the sergeant where I was. And he says, oh, he says, he gave me a hard time. I put him on KP. Dave says, okay, get a Jeep. Come on. This guy's in Class A uniform. He walks in the mess hall with Colonel Schilling. All right, you finish this KP. Come on, Billy. You got a job to do.
Well, you incriminate yourself. It's 50 years. They will lock you up. You're on KP.
I don't trust these English people over here. No, I've been married one of 50 years. I can't have my own key.
Make steady, you've got witnesses.
Yeah.
I can't even have a credit card. Now, I was...
If I gave him a credit card, I would be $1 million in debt by the end of the year. I'd have every damn truck that's gold sitting out my backyard.